We know that Iowa isn't just an endless cornfield, but even those of us who love our subtle landscape might be surprised to learn that Iowa is home to approximately 27,000 recorded archaeological sites. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we'll take a tour of the state with Bill Whitaker and Mary De La Garza, two of the authors of The Archaeological Guide to Iowa. We'll talk about the different cultural periods studied by archaeologists in the state and hit some of the most interesting archaeological hotspots in Iowa. From mounds to mines, from breweries to cheese factories, there's bound to be one near you. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowa has a rich history, and much of it is hidden from view. William Whitaker and Mary De La Garza, two of the authors of The Archaeological Guide to Iowa, will help us uncover some of that hidden history today. Their new book is a guide to 68 different archaeological sites in the state. Bill, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for having us.
And Mary, thank you.
Awesome. Thanks.
So tell me a little bit about the genesis for this book. How did the idea come about? Obviously, you guys spend a lot of time looking at all of the different archaeological sites in Iowa. You have a catalog of, is it 27,000 different sites in Iowa?
It's over 28,000.
Wow.
Really? Wow.
We learned something
new
every day.
It's been a while since I looked. Yeah.
Right. So where did the idea for this book come about?
We get a lot of requests from people about what sites they can visit in Iowa. You know, and there's, you know, if there's 28,000 archaeological sites, you really can't just send people out to go look for sites. And most of the sites that we have in Iowa simply aren't that interesting. You know, they're a spot where a Native American may have knocked off a few flakes of stone while making a projectile point or a spear point, or it might be a farmstead where there's a few bricks left that was recorded during a highway survey. So the vast majority just aren't that interesting. And then there's a lot of sites that are interesting but just are not accessible to the public because they're on private lands or they're sensitive sites and you don't want people to be, you know, mucking around in a site in a remote area. So we thought about creating a list of sites that people could visit throughout the state of Iowa. So I think we got a total of 68 sites, and we intentionally spread them all over the state of Iowa so that everybody would be kind of near a site that they could visit. And we tried to diversify the types of sites that they could find diversify them in terms of age. So we have some of the oldest sites in Iowa you can visit and also some of the most recent historic American sites you can visit in the state as well. Mary?
Yeah, Lynn Alex, another one of the authors, and I officed right next door to each other, and we often talked about trying to get something together that would be visually appealing as well as informative for people to be able to go to or at least get to an area of historic value and enjoy those sites. So I'm an amateur photographer, and I said, I'd love to do the photos for something like that. And then we talked to Bill, and then we talked to Iowa Press, was in on a meeting, and we mentioned it to them, and they were very interested in doing the book. So it went, and what, 3 years later?
So in Iowa, of course, being an agricultural state, a lot of the ground has been disturbed over the years. I mean, a lot of the soil gets turned over every year. How much of a role has that played in finding all of these different historical sites in Iowa?
Well, agriculture is a blessing and a curse for archaeology. It's a blessing in that it exposes a lot of sites. You know, the plow will bring up material to the surface so you can get a good sense of where people were living and what they were doing. And of course, it's a curse because it smears the site all over the place and it destroys hars and other features. It destroys, you know, old farmsteads. It destroys old villages. So it kind of cuts both ways. Agriculture also helps because you have a lot of people going over the land and they see these things. And so, you know, in parts of the country where there's less agriculture, it's a lot harder to find sites because people haven't seen them. Whereas in Iowa, you can go and talk to people and they can tell you about the artifacts found and where they came from. So, yeah, it cuts both ways. The best sites, the best preserved sites we have in Iowa are in river valleys because unlike upland level areas, the soil's accretional, meaning that the soil builds up and buries sites. But the problem with that is that a deeply buried site is very hard to find and it isn't going to be plowed up. So the best preserved sites tend to be in the low areas, but the easiest to find sites tend to be in the upland areas like the farm fields.
All right. And in looking at the map that you included with this book, there are the vast majority of the sites that you included are along rivers.
Yeah. And a lot of it is because, you know, Native Americans did live near major riverways.
Right. People need water.
Not only that, they didn't dig wells, but not only that, but they also, that's where the food is. If you're in a wide river valley, you have all kinds of resources around. You have wetlands, you have river streams, you have large river channels, you have upland areas all near you. So you can get all different kinds of foods from different times of the year if you live near a river valley. So the larger sites do tend to accumulate near the river, larger river systems.
All right. Well, I want to talk about some of the different cultural periods that you study as archaeologists in Iowa. I think we in the public often just tend to lump everything together. There was that time before the settlers came, and then there was the time after the settlers came. So let's go way back in time and start with the first period that you study, the Paleo-Indian period. And you do, in the introduction, you write about these names, because the names that you use for these different periods are somewhat controversial, and there's no perfect name for these different periods, right?
Yeah. In archaeology and in most of the literature, we tend to use terms like prehistoric and historic. And these terms are from the 19th century, and they refer to the original sense of the word history, meaning written, meaning that these are like prehistoric sites are before Europeans came along with written text. And that is literally true, but the sense of the word history has changed over time, and so that we now include things like oral history and storytelling and song history as part of history. And Native Americans certainly have extremely deep histories in the sense of that sense of the term. And so they often kind of balk at the term prehistoric and historic and say, hey, we have history too, and our history goes way back before Europeans were here, which is totally true. But then you have to decide, well, if you don't want to use prehistoric and historic, what terms do you use? People have suggested using pre-Columbian. Well, but then, do you really want to define Native Americans by, a European who was completely clueless where he was and started the slave trade and Native Americans? Do you really want to define, your past by that? Other terms that are commonly used are pre-contact, which, again, you're defining yourself by your association with Europeans instead of by your own history. So there really hasn't emerged like a perfect term yet to define what we call prehistoric. So for this book, we do stick with the terms prehistoric and historic, but we're certainly open to changing it as the culture changes.
Right, and of course we need to have language in common here, so
yes.
We'll go with what we have. And let's talk about the Paleo-Indian period. This is 13,500 to 10,500 years ago, and this would have been the time when the first humans were in Iowa, right?
Yeah, there's some debate about that. There's lots of people believe in that there were people here before that time period, but nobody's made that claims in Iowa yet. The clearest occupations we have are the people who made Clovis spear points, which is about 13,000 years ago. In the state of Iowa, we have lots of sites that have Paleo-Indian points and material in them, but there is no site with good preservation from the Paleo-Indian period. There's like the Carlisle Cache, which has some preforms that were buried in a pit, but there's no organics preserved with that. There's just the points, and that's about it. There's no good preservation. But during this time period, people are highly mobile. They don't appear to have established large settlements, at least not in this area. And that doesn't help the situation as far as finding sites that are preserved. So they tend to be very ephemeral and scattered all over the place, which is kind of how we find the sites. This would have been the time period when the last of the glaciers were melting. There would have been a little nubbin left of a glacier up in north central Iowa, part of the Des Moines Lobe. And the landscape would have looked very different from what it does today. It wouldn't have been prairie. It would have been sort of a boreal forested area, and over time it would slowly become what it is today, you know, predominantly a prairie state.
The next period is the Archaic period, and this is a big chunk of time. This is 10,500 to 2,800 years ago.
Yeah, that's the majority of prehistory. This is when humans were becoming very settled into the local environments. They're starting to specialize in local resources. The spear points become much more divergent in style, and you start seeing local varieties. In the Middle Archaic, you start seeing clear evidence of substantial house structures, and we've excavated some of those in Iowa. You start seeing evidence of long-distance trade rather than simple long-distance movement. And at the very end, you start seeing manifestations of localization. Like, you start seeing the very beginnings of agriculture and the very beginnings of ceramic production, the very beginnings of mound building. Things that are associated with later periods really appear towards the end of the Archaic period.
And I feel like in recent years, we've learned a lot about this period of time and the people who lived in Iowa during this period of time. I mean, I remember when I was studying Iowa history when I was a kid, it was sort of like, well, there were Indians before that, and they probably lived in teepees. But yeah. Now, I mean, we have evidence of some of the settlements and some of the dwellings, and they look very different from the kinds of things that we thought Native people would have lived in.
Yeah, that's been a fairly recent phenomenon in Iowa archaeology. We've had a few sites that have evidence of house structures. I know Bear Creek Archaeology, a good firm out of Cresco, Iowa, has excavated some archaic period structures along the Mississippi Basin, and our office has excavated a fairly large archaic site called the Palace Site in Des Moines. Mary was there. What did you think of the Palace Site?
Well, what really interested me about the Palace Site was the extensive clam midden that was found, and I just thought it was really beautiful, and it suggested there was several occupations in that time period. I think, Bill, you said five maybe, or?
Yeah, five. Yeah.
Five times of folks going out there and having clam midden parties.
and this is in Des Moines?
This is outside of Des Moines on the east side in an area that is a sewer development plant. And it was discovered while they were doing some excavation. And then they called us in to look at it, and there were some human remains found. And that's when they determined it was an archaic site. Is that correct, Bill?
Yeah, you know, They were expanding the wastewater treatment plant in Des Moines, and during construction, several features appeared, like scatters of clams and bivalves, several hearths and charcoal stains, and the excavation kind of appeared to show houses popping up.
And we'll have to pick up there in just a moment. We have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Bill Whitaker and Mary De La Garza. They're two of the authors of the new book, The Archaeological Guide to Iowa. And the public's invited to a book release reception for The Archaeological Guide to Iowa tomorrow evening from 6 to 7:30 at the Museum of Natural History in Iowa City. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with two of the authors of The Archaeological Guide to Iowa. Bill Whitaker is a research archaeologist with the Office of the State Archaeologist. Mary De La Garza is a program director at the University of Iowa Office of the State Archaeologist. They are with me today. I also ran out of time to fully mention, but there is a public reception, a book release reception for both this book, The Archaeological Guide to Iowa, and also Dubuque's Forgotten Cemetery, both published very recently by the University of Iowa Press. It's at the University of Iowa Museum of Natural History tomorrow evening from 6 to 7:30. And just before the break, we were in the Archaic period, which is 10,500 to 2,800 years ago. And we were talking specifically about the Palace site, which is number 24 on your list of 68 sites in Iowa. And this one is in Polk County. It's near Des Moines. And again, this was a construction site that things started surfacing in. So, yeah. You know, including this in the book, if somebody wanted to go to the Palace site, A, could they? And B, what would they see?
Well, they cannot literally walk on the Palace site grounds because it's part of the wastewater treatment facility. they can get very close to it and look at it through the fence, and we do give you directions to look at it through the fence if you're so inclined. Some of the sites we have are like that. You know, we can get you close to them, or we can discuss them, or we can point you towards a museum that has artifacts from it. And you know, we try to get you a lot of sites where you can actually go, but sometimes, you know, you just physically cannot go to the site. But we give you some place you can go, some place you can see.
Well, and you were talking about the wastewater treatment plant, and looking at the list of sites that fall in this archaic period, there's also the Cherokee sewer site. So Is there something about digging for sewers that has to do with the archaic period?
There absolutely is. That's a great observation. Because typically when we look for sites, we don't dig really deep in floodplains because, you know, the soil is very hard. It often has a lot of clay, and it's very difficult to get out of the ground and to push through a screen. So there isn't a lot of survey, and the sites are deeply buried, so they aren't shown by the plow. But they have great preservation because the sites are buried quickly, and the bones can preserve, and the organic material, like the cooking remains of seeds and nuts, can preserve in these sites because they're buried in these floodplains. And in a sewage treatment facility, because it moves a lot of dirt to make the treatment facility, and they're always located in floodplains, they are going to be the places where these very old, well-preserved sites are going to be found. And the Cherokee sewer site is a great site, multiple occupations. The oldest might be terminal Paleo-Indian. It's more likely to be actually early Archaic, through the middle Archaic. And at least four different events occurred at the Cherokee sewer site in which Native Americans processed bison that they had hunted nearby. And so you can see changes in how they process bison over time from the lowest occupation, the oldest, to the newest. And, you know, you can see a little bit of changes in their hunting strategy as the climate warms up, and you can see changes in tool style. So, yeah, we're always grateful when a big project like a sewage treatment plant comes in and finds stuff that we can excavate.
Well, and of course, now when somebody is doing this kind of excavation and they find something, they have to call you. Does it also make you think, or do they? Is that... you had a look on your face, Bill, that told me otherwise.
Well, the only in Iowa, the statewide laws as far as prehistoric and historic sites goes, for the vast majority of cases, you have to report if you encounter human remains or think you're about to encounter human remains. Most people, if they're building a subdivision or they're putting in a well or they're building a foundation for their house or whatever, they are not required to do anything archaeologically. Archaeology is triggered under Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation Act or whatever, that requires that if you get federal funding or a federal permit, then you have to take historic properties into consideration. And that triggers archaeological survey and often mitigation of these sites. That's why Cherokee sewer site that's why the Powell site was excavated in Des Moines. It's because they received federal funds for that project.
Okay. All right. So does it also make you think about all of the projects that have been done where no one called?
Yeah, I don't like to think about that.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move on. Are there any other sites that fall into that archaic period that you want to talk about before we move on to the woodland period?
One that's near us right now is the Edgewater Park site, which was in Coralville. You have that new development down by the riverfront. And what's the hotel there? Is that the Marriott? The big hotel
down on the river landing.
The Outer River Landing. Immediately north of the hotel, there's a parking ramp. And immediately north of that, there's a big open field. And they were planning to have a big development there. It was going to be like the center for the book. And then it became something else. And they still haven't developed it. But in 2004, we had to kind of hustle and excavate an archaic site that was there, and it's called the Edgewater Park site. And we found a small encampment that was occupied about 4,000 years ago, in which people were doing some processing of D deer. They were utilizing some local plants, and they were resharpening tools. They had a few hars. And we could tell from the lithics and the lithic reduction, they had just come down the Iowa River from the center of the state. And we could tell from the plants and animals that they were probably in late summer or early fall. So they're kind of heading south of the winter, we like to think. But the interesting thing was is that it has some very early introduced plants. It had a little barley and may grass, which are not locally native, but are later domesticated plants. And this is at a time period where there's no clear evidence of domestication in Iowa, but there's clear domestication in southeast United States. So the argument was, maybe this is like the earliest hints of domestication when people are introducing new plants to an area. It's like the very first stages of
agriculture.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, fascinating.
And the excavation portion of this was very interesting also because it was cold for one thing. I remember we had to have a tent up and we had to heat up the ground, and we used water for the excavation technique, which usually we don't do that for screening. Usually it's just a screen that we shake back and forth and the dirt falls through, but water was used in that instance. And also how to get the seeds out once you've got your samples of earth that come back to our lab, and they go to our wet lab, and then the float machine takes those, and then the seeds will float to the top, and that's how we get to see those kinds of things.
Fascinating. We're talking about the Archaeological Guide to Iowa this hour. With me are two of the authors of the book, Bill Whitaker and Mary De La Garza. And you're welcome to join the conversation as well with your questions if you have questions about a site near you. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I want to move into the woodland period. And this is 800 BC through 1250 AD. And this is the period that I think a lot of people are fascinated by in Iowa, because this is the time of the mound builders, right?
Yeah. So after the Archaic, Native Americans have really settled into local regions, and you start seeing some of the more spectacular sites, at least that you can see above ground. This is the time period when Effigy Mounds National Monument is really being utilized. And for those of you who haven't seen Effigy Mounds National Monument, well, shame on you. It's probably the most scenic spot in the whole state of Iowa. I mean, you haven't seen Iowa if you haven't been to Effigy Mounds. It's a beautiful, beautiful site. I mean, even if there weren't mounds there, it would be just a gorgeous destination. It almost looks like a mountainous region with these beautiful forests overlooking the huge Mississippi Valley. And you have these wonderful effigy mounds shaped like animals, shaped like bears, shaped like birds along the bluff tops and even in the bottoms at the Snymagill unit to the south. And they have a great museum and exhibit there. So, you know, that's the most spectacular mound site we have in Iowa. But there are mounds actually throughout the state. And one of the temptations we had with the book was to just pile on the mounds because they're beautiful and everybody can see them. You can really appreciate when you get out there. But that's only part of the story. So we had to dial it back a little bit on the mounds and, you know, really emphasize some subterranean sites that you may not see. You know, mound sites are also, some of the sites we also have are areas where mounds have been destroyed, like downtown Des Moines used to have a large mound group right in the center of town. Long gone. It's been totally paved over.
Can you still see mounds in Des Moines?
Nope. They're not within downtown. They're
covered.
Yeah, they are covered.
You know, obviously with effigy mounds, you cannot disturb those mounds. They're burial places, they're sacred places, and you're not going to dig up a mound. I'm sure that many mounds have been dug up in the state of Iowa, though. I mean, not necessarily intentionally. What do we know about what's in there?
Well, as far as effigy mounds is concerned, they were looted heavily before we even started to investigate them archaeologically. The park itself was founded in 1949, and it was Elson Orr and Charles Keyes that included them in this prehistoric mound area. The mounds, what's I think the most beautiful about those mounds are the bear shapes, the marching bear shapes going up the hill all the way up to the top of effigy mounds, which is just spectacular, as Bill mentioned. Most of the artifacts, as I said, were looted out, but the things that we did glean from that were mostly pottery. Is that correct, Bill? And there was an interesting orientation to the burials that we did find, and not all of these mounds are burials, by the way.
Yeah. When she says we, she actually means archaeologists in the past. I mean, in Iowa, it hasn't been. It's essentially we haven't done a purely research excavation of a mound since the early 1970s. It's just not done anymore because of the burial laws that we have in place in Iowa. There was a time period after the founding of the park and before excavation of mounds was essentially prohibited that there was some scientific excavations done of mounds. And there isn't typically a lot of material within the mounds. You find some human remains. You find some pottery, but very, very little actually there. And it's because, you know, these are burial spots. These aren't occupation spots. You know, the vast quantities of artifacts tend to be found at occupation sites where people are living and doing daily stuff, and they have lots of refuse around them and the debris of daily life. Whereas you don't get that in mound sites. These are places where people are interred, and so there isn't a lot of daily activity going on around them.
You know, this is another part of history I feel like we've learned so much about recently because, again, when I was a kid and learning about the mound builders, there was a lot of, we don't really know.
Yeah.
We don't know who did it. We don't know how they lived. But, wow, these are pretty amazing. So, I mean, you list a number of sites where you have found these daily living sites, and we've learned a lot more about the mound builders.
Yeah. Mound builders is, you know, pretty much anybody who lived during the woodland or even the late prehistoric period were probably mound builders. And, you know, mounds were constructed as primarily as burial sites. There's all kinds of different ways that these burials occurred. Some were placed into the mound. Sometimes the person was buried and the mound was built on top of them. Some of the earliest excavations, like in the early 20th century, focused just on the mounds, not surprisingly, because, you know, go there. But then later excavations, as we learn more about what's going on, focus more on the occupation areas. And you can see the types of food that's being utilized, the types of when different types of domesticated crops appear, what types of animals they're hunting, how things change over time. You can see the appearance of the bow and arrow through the appearance of stone arrowheads. Just these gradual changes that come through the excavation of the occupation areas as opposed to the mounds themselves.
Where are the most interesting sites? And of course, I know that this is something where you can't necessarily go and see what archaeologists have seen, but where are some of the most interesting sites where you have been able to learn about the daily life of these people?
Oh, sure. We do have an interactive map your listeners can look to. The easiest way to find it would be just, you know, go on Facebook and do a search for Archaeological Guide to Iowa. And there'll be a link there to, I uploaded some maps to Harvard's World Map System where you can download to devices the locations that we mentioned in the book. So you can actually physically find them a lot easier than trying to squint at our map in the book. And by devices, I'm not a guy who actually has a smartphone, so I'll take the word on it that you can download apps for your phone.
Right, and the actual address to that is harvard.edu/data/geonode_iowa_archaeology_sites_lys.
And we will have that up in our web post at iowapublicradio.org. We'll also put a link to it on our Facebook page when we post the show later on today. Shall we move on to the next historic period, or is there anything you want to make sure we talk about before we leave the woodland period?
Well, I'd like to talk about the idea of creating an application that will guide you to the spots that we talked about.
Okay.
Also, the historic sites that we can visit. And we're trying to get funding together to do something like that. But in essence, what it'll be is that you can put it on your phone or your tablet, and you can walk in an area, and it will pull up the site area where you can go and visit. So it'll also contain some other information. It'll tell you where the site was excavated, if we can, and also if it's historic, if it's archaic. I'll give you all the information that we have in the book, as well as a little bit more information if we put that in about the waterways and those kinds of things. Our office is going to be developing that probably in the next year.
The whole idea of sending people to these archaeological sites, I mean, so many of them, when you go, you can't see a great deal. What's special about going to a site and just having the knowledge that something happened here?
Well, you know, it's always one thing to just read something in a book, but it's quite another to actually see where it happened. You know, it's kind of analogous to, you know, Civil War battlefields. You can't see the cannons go off, but when you go out there, you really get a sense of the landscape that they're in, the landscape that influenced them. You can see, and the way you picture a site is never how it appears when you actually visit it. You know, it's always much more in the moment when you actually see the site and know that people have been there and what's been going on there in the past. You know, you can get so much more out of a location if you know its history than simply by walking over it. I mean, this is why you have, you know, medieval tours in Europe. This is, you know, one thing that we really try to promote in Iowa.
I'll cut you off again. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Bill Whitaker and Mary De La Garza. They are two of the authors of The Archaeological Guide to Iowa, published by University of Iowa Press. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with two of the authors of the new book, The Archaeological Guide to Iowa. And there is a reception coming up tomorrow evening from 6 to 7:30, a book release reception for this book, The Archaeological Guide to Iowa, and also Dubuque's Forgotten Cemetery, which also was recently released. And I also recently talked to the authors on Talk of Iowa. That's at the University of Iowa Museum of Natural History, tomorrow evening between 6 and 7:30. With me today, Bill Whitaker. He's a research archaeologist at the Office of the State Archaeologist, and Mary De La Garza is a program director also with the Office of the State Archaeologist. And Bill, just before the break, we were talking about what it means to go to these sites, even if you can't necessarily see the history that is involved and the archaeological information that you've recovered from a site isn't always visible to the naked eye when you go to a place. Did you want to finish your thought on that?
Oh, sure. I mean, beyond just the sense of awe that can come from being at a place that you know something significant has happened, as an archaeologist, I have a very selfish reason to send people out to these sites. Because archaeology will not happen if the public isn't interested in it. And the best way to get the public interested in it is to get them to these sites and to have people realize that they are in their backyards, that they're all over the place, that they are important, they are special, that they're out there. And unless you actually go to, for example, Effigy Mounts National Monument, you're not really going to understand just how amazing these things are. You will not get the sense of awe that you get from standing on that bluff and next to this large, beautiful Indian mound looking up and down for miles down that river valley. So we really, you know, for very concrete reasons, we need people to go out to these sites and to appreciate them just for the sake of the future of archaeology and history in Iowa.
Well, and Mary, you are not an archaeologist, but you work with archaeologists. So when you go to these sites, what does it mean to you?
I think for me, it's the awesomeness of what happened before I'm very interested in, because I'm interested in history and the history of people. But the biggest part for me is to look at the landscape and imagine how they would live. And when you look at these vast landscapes where these rolling hills and you can imagine the buffalo being out on the plains and you can imagine what it might be like to live there, taking the photos to try to show what it would feel like to look at these sites and not show the people working on them was a very difficult job. At first, I thought I could do it, that this is going to be easy and fun, but I was completely wrong about it. It was more about imagining the landscape populated, and I thought it was just a wake-up for me, seeing these sites that that are so vast, and feeling as if I was part of that, especially Effigy Mounds National Monument, which is my absolute favorite site, because there's bluffs and the trees are amazing. There are several different kinds of trees up in that area, and we know that the occupations were probably below the bluff area along the Mississippi. But the mound portion, looking at those and trying to shoot them from the ground and not from the air, and get them to show up, that was difficult. And once I did get a few that worked that way, I was really pleased. And I think I felt more a part of that group than I would have otherwise.
Let's move into the next cultural period, the late prehistoric period, and this would be 900 to 1600 AD. And this is a period of history that we know significantly more about than some of these earlier places. But tell us a little bit about it, Bill.
Sure. When the earliest European explorers came to North America, in Juliet and Marquette, went down the Mississippi, the people they encountered are part of a group we would call the Oneota, the late prehistoric occupants of Iowa. These are people who descended probably from the late woodland occupations throughout the state. These are the ancestors of the tribes that are known to have lived in Iowa in that time period. For example, the Ho-Chunk, the Winnebago, the Iowa, the Missouri, the Oto, and they lived differently than late woodland people. They had larger settlements. They ate a lot more corn. They sometimes had enclosures around their settlements, like they had ditch fortifications and embankments. Their settlements were more widely dispersed. In western Iowa, you have more substantial houses, called earth lodges, where people dug into the ground that had huge timbered structures on top of it. And in western Iowa, you'd have like the ancestors would be like the ancestors of Pawnee, Arikara, and other tribes. So you have much more substantial structures. You have you start to see the appearance of tribes that are historically known. You have historic accounts of what's going on at these different time periods. And there's still some surprises that come up. Recently, there was some excavations down at Iowaville, which is an Iowa Indian settlement in Van Buren County, in which they discovered through magnetic survey that a large part of the site was surrounded by a circular embankment enclosure that they didn't know about at all. And this was one of the last Oneota-style enclosures ever made in Iowa. So you have this spectacular site that's been recently excavated and has lots of trade material coming from Europe, from European sources. But they're still using local Native American foods. They're still using local Native American animals, with the exception of horses. So you see this transition from the prehistoric to the historic at these later Oneota sites.
What are some of the sites in this period that are your favorites?
Oh, well, Iowaville, obviously. There's Blood Run, which is just becoming a large monument in northwest Iowa. In fact, almost as far northwest as you can get in Iowa. And Blood Run was a huge historically known site, and it appears in early maps dating back to the 1700s. This is a lot of the tribes from the region occupied Blood Run at various times.
And you use some pretty powerful language in the book when describing the Blood Run historic site, a national historic landmark without equal. So this is something that you as a team must feel pretty strongly about.
Yeah, it's just a spectacular site. Lynn, who is one of our co-authors, has done far more work on Blood Run. But she's just recently retired, and she's off visiting grandchildren and old friends, and so she couldn't be with us here today. But yeah, she this is certainly her focus, and I'd have her speak more to it. But yeah, there's a lot of great sites. There's even little sites can be quite fascinating. There's a site called Wanampito, which is in Bremer County, that has like probably a small site, but it has a lot of artifacts from the 1600s in it, which is just fascinating. You have like these little tinkler cones made out of metal along with stone projectile points. You know, you don't see that very often. It's usually it's one or the other, but to have stone with metal at the same site is very rare. And there's actually a nice exhibit at a nature center called Heary Woods Nature Center in Clarksville, Iowa, that has just this wonderful display, catlinite pipes and other artifacts from the Wanampito site. So, yeah, there's a lot of great stuff out there.
All right. And then we know a lot more about the next periods, the proto-historic period, 1600 to 1800, and then, of course, the historic period, post-1800. I mean, how much work do archaeologists need to be doing in that period?
Well, I think there's a lot of work to do in that period still. We have a historical archaeological fellow that works in our office, and I think we have two, right? Marlon is also a...
Oh, historians, yeah.
Historian. Yeah, yeah. And we can glean a lot of information from the buildings, the structures. For instance, the one site that comes to mind for me would be the Elgin Brewery, because it was so... You could still see the malt house. You could still see the interior as far as the way the staircases were built, those kinds of things. And even though we know a lot about the historical side, we don't necessarily know about everything. And so picking up those little pieces and pulling them together is just as important, I think.
Can you give me an idea of some of the things that you're working on right now in the Office of the State Archaeologist?
Well, this fall we finished up a pretty substantial excavation right down the street from our office at the Hubbard Park, which is, if you know the University of Iowa campus, it's the park that's just south of the Iowa Memorial Union. And there was a working-class neighborhood that stood there from about 1840 until, I think, 1926. It was demolished. And that is a great site because it's well-preserved. You have this very early historic deposits that were first – possibly covered by a flood, the flood of 1851, buried the topsoil. And then after the park was abandoned, it was all infilled. So you have all these early town features that have been preserved there. So this winter, we've been going through all these artifacts we found from there. And it's just a phenomenal glimpse into a forgotten part of Iowa history. Because you don't really... You know, working class people are pretty much absent from the history of Iowa. Like there's a couple of histories written about Johnson County, and they'll include histories of 600 people in them. But all of them, almost all of them are white, male, large property owners. And you hear about their history, but you don't hear about the history of the majority of people who aren't that.
Especially the people who lived in communities in Iowa. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we know more about our rural history in some ways than we do about the towns and the people who lived there and worked there.
Yeah, and Hubbard Park is, you know, it's one block from the state capitol, and it's right on the university grounds. And there's been all kinds of histories written about the capitol, all kinds of histories written about the university, but almost no mention of anybody who lived on this block. You know, they're just sort of working poor in the shadow of the Capitol, and we could see, you know, how they're changing, you know, over the 70 or 80 years that the neighborhood was there. We can see how the neighborhood changes. We can see the type, how they change what they're eating, the types of features that they have, how they change over time. So it's just a great glimpse into a forgotten part of Iowa history.
There must be some real push and pull between people who are hoping to build buildings and start developments and that kind of thing, and then archaeologists who want to take the time to actually excavate a site. And we talked earlier about what triggers a phone call to the Office of the State Archaeologist. But do you try to convince people ever to let you look first, even if they're not required to call you?
There are areas that we'll hear about things that are sensitive, and we'll... Even if they're not required to do survey, we'll kind of talk to them a little bit about what's going on and why it's significant. And sometimes they're amenable, and it always comes down to money, of course, and money and time. Like the university, for example, they've been extremely cooperative, and they get it. They understand the importance of the site, and you know they were very helpful in our excavation. So I've gotten, you know, we had a great experience with them. And then other times when we're required to do it, because it's usually because you're getting federal money and there's federal permitting, there's you tend to have bigger planners who understand these issues, who understand that the archaeology has to go on. They understand that this is something that you have to accommodate for, like highway projects. You know, probably the majority of archaeology occurs in Iowa because of highway projects. And the DOT understands this, and they have set contracts for archaeology and archaeological survey, and they're quite cooperative and quite responsive. And that's just because it's institutionalized, and they also understand that, you know, the archaeology is one half of 1% of the final budget. So it's, if you plan for it, it's not a deal breaker, and you can just get a tremendous reward, a tremendous cultural reward for doing all the survey and work for a comparatively small cost.
So both of you have, I think, made it pretty clear that if I could pick just one archaeological site in Iowa to go to, it would be Effigy Mounds.
Right.
What's number two on your list? Where else would you send people for sure?
I would say to the Glenwood area.
Why?
That was a site that had a lot of earth lodgy kind of houses, and it's beautiful on that side of the state. It's over in western Iowa, about almost southern southwestern Iowa, but it's very extensive. In fact, we're working on a project that is closing on Glenwood that I'm building a photographic portal for. And the photos from that time period in that area are just magnificent.
And so this is the Glenwood Archaeological State mm-hmm. Preserve. And what kinds of things have been found there?
Again, that would be pottery and stone tools, those kinds of things. I think the most important part for me is the landscape and how amazing that would have been to live in and imagining living in that area and thinking that that would be the place to go. That's where I would live. I think it would be a lot warmer than up in Effigy Mounds National Park.
Yeah, you know, if we say that Effigy Mounds is the most beautiful spot in Iowa, certainly the Luss Hills is probably the second most beautiful spot in Iowa. You know, just stunning. Yeah.
So do you have a different second choice, or would the Glenwood Archaeological State Preserve also be your second choice, Bill?
Oh, if I were to say somebody to visit something?
Yeah.
You know, there's a state park called Malchow Mounds that is north of Burlington, right on the bluffs. There's a nice little parking lot. It's a little bit of a steep hike, short steep hike. And you get to this spot, and it's just packed with mounds. It's like mound on top of mound on top of mound on top of mound. We tried mapping it 5 years ago, and we mapped it very intensively through this high grass, and you'd see the person holding the stadia rod that's used to measure things, and boom, he would suddenly drop down because he couldn't see that the edge of a mound was there in the grass. And then we produce these maps, and we realize we can't even tell how many mounds they are because it's hard to tell where one ends and one begins.
Wow.
And it's just a beautiful scenery. Malchow Mounds would be someplace. If you just, you know, I want to take a drive somewhere for a day and just, a little hefty hike up a short trail up a bluff, and you'll just see a beautiful, beautiful sight. So, yeah.
Bill, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Bill Whitaker is a research archaeologist with the Office of the State Archaeologist. Mary De La Garza, thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Mary De La Garza is program director with the Office of the State Archaeologist. They are two of the three authors, along with Lynn Alex, of The Archaeological Guide to Iowa. And the public's invited to a book release reception for The Archaeological Guide to Iowa and also Dubuque's Forgotten Cemetery. It's at the University of Iowa Museum of Natural History tomorrow evening between 6 and 7:30. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Julia Davis. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.